Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for August's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European Veterinary Specialist in Emergency and Critical Care, Chiara Faltalina. Thank you, Chiara. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure for me to be here and to give this talk on emergency treatment of the brain injury patients. So, when we talk about traumatic brain injury, or let's call it a trauma, it's definitely a common presentation in small animal. And most of the time, it is the result of a blunt trauma, which can be, again, hit by car, cats that fell from high store or from trees. They also, obviously, can be also results of a penetrating trauma, but usually blunt trauma is definitely the most common mechanism for traumatic brain injury. And it's been reported in an article a few years ago that evaluated actually blunt trauma, or let's say the damage associated to blunt trauma in a population of dogs, that 25% of this patient did present actually with signs of traumatic brain injury. But because, again, as I say, trauma is most of the time the underlying cause for an animal to present with also traumatic brain injury, then it is very important not to focus in these animals only on the neurological examination, but to assess this patient as we would assess and we would initially evaluate every emergency patient that walked through the door. Because often we know that trauma patients, they often suffer from multi-trauma. So often patients with traumatic brain injury, they don't only have traumatic brain injury, but they might be suffering also from shock. They might be suffering from a problem with the respiratory system. They might have maybe emo abdomen. So it's very important that we just don't focus only on the neurological examination, but again, we keep our focus on the major body system of this patient. So again, our initial assessment for, as I said, for almost every emergency patient should evaluate the triage, which means patient evaluation and the prioritization of the problems that we see. And our attention should focus mainly on the major body system, meaning the cardiovascular assessment, evaluation obviously of the heart rate, the peripheral pulse quality, color of mucous membrane, capillary fall time, and obviously the mental state. Respiratory system, we need to evaluate the respiratory rate, the efforts, and pulmonary auscultation. And then we're going to talk obviously about the central nervous system. Remember also that these patients, especially patients that suffer from trauma, suffer also from pain, and we're talking often about acute pain. So don't forget in this patient, even if they are suffering from shock or they're suffering from traumatic brain injury, to consider also administer analgesia. We're going to talk about what analgesic we can use in this type of patient towards the end of this presentation. So again, why do we have to keep on focusing also on the other major body system? Why can't I just focus, for example, on the neurological system if I can already see that my patient suffers from a traumatic brain injury? Well, it's very important that we recognize hypovolemia and hypoxemia, because in human medicine, they are strongly correlated with increased intracranial pressure and increased mortality, again, in human traumatic brain injury victim. The respiratory function is also very important for us to evaluate. And animals that suffer from trauma, from multi-trauma, they might actually have concurrent injury like pneumothorax, hemothorax, rib fracture, or pulmonary contusion that might affect the way they are breathing and might affect their, again, ventilation and also their oxygenation. Another important reason why we need to evaluate this patient also their respiratory function is that there is a possibility that patients that develop also traumatic brain injury, they might suffer from what is called a neurogenic pulmonary edema. It's a non-cardiogenic edema, and the pathogenesis of a neurogenic pulmonary edema is not yet completely understood. However, it is believed that there is a overstimulation at the central nervous system of the sympathoadrenal activity, which would cause a rapid marked peripheral vasoconstriction and then an increase in venous return. And this often then will result in systemic hypertension that would also lead to an increase in the left ventricular afterload and a decrease in ventricular stroke volume. So the blood then will accumulate in the pulmonary circulation, resulting in increasing capillary pressure and subsequent edema. So it's very good that if we have a patient that presents with severe traumatic brain injury and severe dyspnea, that we evaluate to make sure that one of these abnormalities is also not present. Furthermore, patients with traumatic brain injury, they might also present with a very abnormal breathing pattern, not associated to any of the previous mentioned abnormalities, but associated to either increased intracranial pressure or damage at the central nervous system that might affect also the respiratory center. So there are different type of breathing pattern that we might see in this patient and we should be able to recognize. For example, the Chine-Stokes breathing. And the Chine-Stokes is usually associated to hyperapnea followed by a period of apnea and is usually signs of a, again, cerebral disease or increased intracranial pressure. There is another type of respiratory pattern which is called a central neurogenic hyperventilation, meaning that the patient would constantly hyperventilate but not to compensate to a metabolic problem, usually again because there is a midbrain lesion that is affecting also the respiratory center for which they keep on breathing very, very fast. Another respiratory pattern that we might see in this patient is called apneusis, meaning that the patient then normally has an inspiratory phase and then take a very, very, very long pause at full inspiration and then starts again. And then there is the ataxic breathing, which is usually a breathing that is completely irregular and is very regular in frequency and very irregular in depth. And most of the time, this ataxic breathing, or so called, it is a breathing pattern that might present just before an animal suffers either from apnea or from, again, a respiratory collapse, a cardiopulmonary arrest. So again, as an emergency clinician, when we evaluate this patient, we should be able to recognize also this breathing pattern and then, again, try to see if we can do something to offer our stabilization to these patients. Neurological system, obviously, when we have an animal that suffers from multi-trauma and we have the suspicion of a possible brain injury, we have to pay attention to our neurological system and we have to evaluate the mentation, we have to evaluate the posture, and then we're going to evaluate, obviously, the cranial nerve, vestibular system, and the visual system. When we talk about evaluating mentation, we know that mentation in an animal is always normal if the animal is able to respond to normal stimulation. That can be, for example, calling him, respond to his name, to normal touch. Now, an animal that has a normal mentation is for sure an animal that is not suffering from traumatic brain injury. An animal that is obtunded or soporous is an animal that most of the time again, it doesn't respond to normal stimulation in a normal way, but still is able, for example, to respond to touch. An animal that is stuporous, and I have the first video here. Let me see if the video starts. The patient that is, again, stupor is a patient that doesn't respond to any stimulation. And the only stimulation that we can do to try to wake him up is very deep pain, like you can see in the video of this dog. And the only way that this dog would open the eyes and sort of have a response, it was by me pinching very hard. And the patient that is in a coma is actually a patient that doesn't respond to any stimulation, not even a deep pain stimulation. An animal that is suffering from traumatic brain injury usually is an animal that is stuporous or comatose. And severe decreased level of consciousness usually indicates an abnormal function of the cerebral cortex or obviously an interference with the transmission of sensory stimuli by the brainstem and the reticular activating system. So again, most of the time, patients that do present in coma, they might have bilateral or more general abnormalities in the central nervous system. And often they have, at least in human medicine, a more guarded prognosis. Posture is something else that we need to look and we need to recognize in these patients. And it's often important to distinguish between a decerebellated rigidity or a decerebrated rigidity because they say the underlying brain damage is very different, but as well as obviously the underlying outcome of the patients. So most of the time, they say the cerebellated rigidity is a patient that presents with opisthotonus, with extension or hyperextension of the front limbs. Most of this time, the hind limb can be either extended or either flexed. This patient might have some voluntary movement and is usually responsive. And then it means often that there is a damage at the cerebellum, but it doesn't indicate a severe central nervous system problem or increased intracranial pressure. Now, the cerebrated rigidity is a different story. Often it presents with an animal with opisthotonus, with the front leg and the hind leg being hyper-extended and rigid, and is very often associated with a severe decrease in their mental state, so often these patients are actually comatose. And most of the time, again, decerebrated rigidity, if present, again, is associated with worse prognosis. So again, these are two postures that we should be able to recognize, we should be able to make a distinction in our patient who presents after trauma. Because these are also multi-trauma patients, sometimes, as I said before, we need to look at the pupil. We need to look if the pupil are, if there is again any changes, if there are meiosis, if there are mydriasis. But because again, trauma can also cause an ocular trauma. It's always very important we need to distinguish is what we see if the effect, for example, of eyephema, so blood accumulation, for example, in the eye, or is it second to a trauma to the eye itself, or if it's really an abnormalities of the pupil size that we see secondary to a brain damage. So the pupil size, we know that is given by the oculomotor nerve. There is also sympathetic output, and most of the time, abnormalities of the pupil size indicates an abnormalities at the level of the midbrain. Ocular changes then we can see definitely different type of ocular changes. And let's say that in the absence of concurrent ocular trauma, meiotic pupils usually indicate a loss of the cortical inputs or direct damage to the sympathetic center at the level of the diencephalons. And if the pupils that are actually initially meiotic then become mydriatic and usually unresponsive to light, this indicates that there is a progressive severe brainstem lesion. And this is often what we see when in an animal with a traumatic brain injury, when there is a severe increase in intracranial pressure that might even cause a brain herniation. So again, always look at the eyes, recognize the pupils, see if there is an anisocoria, see if you see meiosis, mydriasis, if there is a response to light, and if not, again, think that the underlying problem can be, again, a serious, brainstem lesion or progressive brainstem lesion. As I say, cranial nerves are also very important. We should try to evaluate all cranial nerves. As I said before, focus on vision and vestibular system. Often animals that present with severe traumatic brain injury, they lack of positional nystagmus and they might have abnormal nystagmus. And most of the time, as I say, we have to suspect the presence of an intracranial problem or increased intracranial pressure. If we have abnormal vision, abnormal pupil size, abnormal vestibular system associated again with a decreased mentation, then this should be enough to raise our index of suspicion that that animal that suffered a trauma or a multi-trauma might also be suffering from a traumatic brain injury. Now, I want to make a point because I see a lot of time also veterinarians that works with me that every time there is an animal, either a cat fest from high store or a dog that is hit by a car and comes here with signs of trauma to the head, then they all start to panic thinking, oh, I have to treat as traumatic brain injury. However, it's important to make a distinction because there are going to be some animal that would present with signs of trauma to the head or to the skull. And they might present with epistaxis, with ocular aural hemorrhage or some cranial nerve abnormalities. There might be a wound or fracture to the head, to the jaw. There can be obviously some mentation abnormalities and there can be some anisocoria. However, is this patient per se suffering from a traumatic brain injury? Or let's say, is every head trauma associated with traumatic brain injury? Well, the answer is actually no. Not all the patients that have a trauma to the head have an underlying traumatic brain injury. So again, we have also to recognize those patients from the population of patients that would present with some sort of trauma to the skull or directly to the head. The patient that actually presents with a head trauma and traumatic brain injury, as I said before, are patients that have a severe alteration of the mental state. So usually, we say before, stuporose or again, comatose or quasi unconscious. And the pupils, yeah, there might be an isochoria, there might be midriatic, but they don't respond to light. There might be no gag. The vestibular, normal vestibular reflex might not be present. They might present with severe irregular breathing patterns, and they might present with decerebrated rigidity. And I'll show you a video of, again, a dog that presents with these abnormalities. And this, again, the dog was not sedated. As you can see, there is epistaxis. I'm going to go closer now with the camera. You can recognize that nystagmus was actually present. And the dog was, again, comatose. The dog was not responsive at all to any stimulation. So this is the patient with definitely signs of head trauma, but also with a traumatic brain injury. And we're going to focus now, again, talking about how we approach them and how we treat them on this type of population of patients. What are the consequences of traumatic brain injury? Well, we usually divide in these consequences in primary damage and secondary damage to the trauma. Now, the primary damage has already occurred when we see this patient, so there is not a lot that we can do about it. And it can be a fracture to the skull. We can have brain concussion, which is usually an acute loss of consciousness, which is often, however, not associated to a severe damage. It can be brain contusion, which is often is hematoma or bleeding in the opposite sides or where the trauma has occurred. And obviously, if we have fracture of the skull that did penetrate, as you can see on the second slides, the brain itself, again, that can cause brain laceration. But as I said before, you know, once we have this patient and we see this patient, they come because they come to the clinic, this primary damage has already occurred. So as a veterinarian, there's not a lot that we can do about it. However, where we can make the difference with the way we treat this patient is to stop and decrease the progression of the so-called secondary damage, which obviously is the consequence of the primary problem. What is all about and what are these secondary damage that we might see or this patient might be suffering from? Well, first of all, imagine that the brain is, there is bleeding, there is an hematoma, there is an edema, and there are going to be some area, and the animal is most likely also can be in shock because they suffer from trauma, so they might suffer from hemorrhage. So there are going to be some area in the brain that are abnormally perfused, and which also means that the cells will not receive enough oxygen. And this will cause the progression of the ischemic lesion and means, again, more damage to the brain because the cells will suffer from hypoxia, some cells will start dying, will go into apoptosis, and will also start releasing in the central nervous system some neurotransmitter. So there is going to be an activation of biochemical and metabolic events that would lead at the end to development of so-called cytotoxic edema and vasogenic edema that contribute enormously to, again, increasing size of the brain and brain edema. And we know that brain edema per se might not be a major issue. However, the brain, it is, again, surrounded by a not expandable structure, which is the skull. So the more the brain edema increases, the more the hematoma gets bigger or there are multiple bleeding, the more the intracranial pressure will increase. But why is intracranial pressure so important? What is the problem if the intracranial pressure increases? So if you look at these slides and you first look at the straight line, this is what normally happens in a normal brain. What does it mean? It means that we know that the brain is usually very good in auto-regulating the cerebral blood flow independently from changes in the mean arterial blood pressure. And here is written as cerebral perfusion pressure. However, if the brain is suffering from a traumatic brain injury, brain edema, bleeding, the brain will lose the ability to maintain and regulate the amount of blood that will go to the brain per minute, the cerebral blood flow. And that will become directly dependent, and you can see again this time the oblique line, it will become directly dependent in the cerebral perfusion pressure. And unfortunately, I need to talk a little bit of physiology, but if you look at this formula, you see that the cerebral perfusion pressure is dependent on the mean arterial, is given by, let's say, the mean arterial blood pressure minus the intracranial pressure. So if you follow me in this sort of reasoning, obviously, to have a good cerebral blood flow, I need to have a high or a good cerebral perfusion pressure, because in a traumatic brain injury, they are dependent. So if the cerebral perfusion pressure is low, my cerebral blood flow will be low. However, if my mean arterial pressure is the same, but my intracranial pressure will increase because, again, of the edema, of the hematoma, then obviously your cerebral perfusion pressure will become smaller. And so your perfusion to the brain, the cerebral blood flow, will also decrease. So increased intracranial pressure, besides then worsening your secondary damage, will decrease the blood flow and would predispose your patient to brain herniation. So increased intracranial pressure, it's bad things for your patients. Normally, we say it's between 5 and 12. It's always the question, when do we treat the patient? And in human medicine, sometimes they use 20 millimeters of mercury. However, in veterinary medicine, it's so difficult, and I think very little places do measure the intracranial pressure. So we often decide to treat the patient if we have a suspicion that intracranial pressure might be high. And as I said before, the brain edema per se, you know, if the skull would be expandable, that might not be a major issue. However, following the Monroe doctrines that say that there is a fixed intracranial volume, which is given by the brain, central, the CSF, and the blood. If one of these components do increase, that would obviously increase a lot of intracranial pressure. And in traumatic brain injury, as I said before, because of hemorrhage, edema, vascular congestion, the size of the brain will increase, so the intracranial pressure, and that will definitely predispose your patient for brain herniation, and then obviously death. I present you a case, and the case is called Avatar. She is a dog, a female castrated, crossbred, around 4 years old. The one I thought was a Chihuahua, but if you look obviously at the picture, you see it probably was not real Chihuahua. And the way she was brought to us is that the owners obviously had her in her arm. She fell on her head. She lost a lot of blood. She had a lot of epistaxis. But the reason why she brought it to us is that, and if I can have the other video now that I can show, that she was stuporous since actually the trauma. There should be a video here. You can see, so this was again taken when she came in, and you can see the massive actually edema and hematoma she had on her forehead. And this was a dog, was again stuporous since admission. When we evaluated Avatar, her initial physical examination, I have here another video, her mental state was stuporous, and she presented opistotonus. I would maybe call it more pleurostotonus. Her heart rate was 50 beats per minute. She had a weak peripheral pulse. Her respiration, there were no major abnormalities. And she had, as you can you could see on the other slides, a large hematoma on the face and on the neck. On gentle palpation of the scar, we could feel there were some fracture of the front, and she had nystagmus. Can I have the video here, please? Yes. And what she was doing is that on and off, she was keep on rolling on herself. So she was unable to maintain a position. This was the pleurostotonus that she was showing, and she was constantly rolling again on the left side, and this was the only position that she could assume. So she was intermittently having this moment, a moment in which she was again stuporous and not reacting. So Avatar definitely suffering from a traumatic brain injury. So the question again is, how do we approach these patients? What are our priorities? And our priorities, as I said before, we cannot do anything with the trauma that just happened, but our priority is trying to minimize secondary damage. We have to support the cerebral blood flow and perfusion. We have to address hypovolemia if hypotension is present, and we have to decrease intracranial pressure if we have the suspicion that intracranial pressure might be elevated. These are our priority. So we have to try and decrease the secondary damage that might, again, then progress the primary brain damage that has already occurred. So we have to try to improve the perfusion to the brain to limit as much as possible the ischemic, secondary ischemic damage that might progress if we would not do that. So our treatment of a patient with a traumatic brain injury revolves around different things. First of all, oxygen administration. We're going to talk a bit more about all of these points. Evaluation of ventilation and try to maintain, again, normal capnia and also normoxia. Fluid therapy to treat the hypovolemia and hypotension if present. What we can do to decrease intracranial pressure, some other, again, important things we need to consider, and then we need to obviously monitor these patients. Now, oxygen administration, it is very important. And again, these are definitely patients that suffer from multi-trauma. We said before, they might suffer also from a respiratory problem. So we would always give oxygen. And we also have to evaluate the type of ventilation. Now, this was another patient that came in with after being hit by a car, suffering from a severe traumatic brain injury. And I hope you can see in the video, the way this patient was breathing quite fast, and on and off it was stopping. It was more of a chain stop breathing. And already you can see the dilated fixed pupils were not responding to light. So this was another patient that presented with severe traumatic brain injury after being hit by a car. And you can also recognize from this slide the decerebrated posture. You see the front legs and the hind legs were again extended and quite rigid. This is the typical presentation of, let's say, one of the severe cases of traumatic brain injury. Now, as I said before, it is also very important that we need to monitor your O2 and the CO2. Now, obviously, it makes sense that if there is a severe, as I said before, a pulmonary a trauma, pulmonary contusion, or again, that affects the ability of the lungs to exchange gases, so we have an hypoxia, then again, obviously, it might well be that there is also decreased oxygen going to the brain. So we have giving supplemental oxygen might be a very good way. However, CO2 is also very important. Why is that? Because actually, hypercapnia, so increasing CO2, would cause cerebral vasodilation and would worsen your brain edema. However, very little CO2, so hypocapnia, would actually cause vasoconstriction at the level of the cerebral vessel, and that would also then predispose your patient to develop hypoxia and to worsen the ischemic, again, lesion. That is why, as I already mentioned before, it's fundamental that the oxygen remains at least, let's say, above 90 millimeters of mercury without oxygen. If we give oxygen, I usually would expect it to be at least 98 or 100%, and the CO2 should be in the normal range, so between 35 and 45 millimeters of mercury. So we don't have to aim for very little, but not either too very high. So it is very important that you try to use everything you have in your clinic, in your practice, to evaluate, again, both oxygenations. You can use, for example, a pulse oximeter, capnograph, for example, extreme capnography might be an idea, especially if your patient is intubated. And obviously, if you have the chances, you can do arterial blood gas to measure both the PaO2 and PaCO2. Or just a venous blood gas, and not obviously to measure your oxygenation, but venous blood gas might be enough at least to measure your CO2. There is very little difference between venous and arterial CO2. So that could be used to evaluate eventually the ventilation of your patients. Obviously, if your patient has an abnormal breathing pattern, if it's hypoxic, if it's hypercapnic, or obviously if he suffers from a respiratory arrest, then that patient needs to be immediately intubated and mechanically or manually ventilated. In the past, and maybe some of you already still know that, in the past, it was suggested hyperventilation of this patient with the idea of, I'm going to try to decrease as much as possible my CO2 so that, again, I cause vasoconstriction of the brain vessel and I would decrease the cerebral edema. I would say careful in doing that because, as I said before, hypocapnia would cause vasoconstriction, which caused decreased cerebral perfusion and mild worsen ischemia. So eventually, intubation and hyperventilation of your patient only in extreme cases. And this was what I did when my ARA treatment didn't work in this case. I had to intubate her and I, again, ventilate her very quickly to cause hypocapnia. You see CO2 is dropping to 3.3 to try to decrease, again, a brain edema and brain herniation. So that should be done, as I said, eventually hyperventilation and hypocapnia in extreme cases and only for a short period of time. Otherwise, again, if you're ventilating your case, ventilate it and try to reach normocapnia and obviously normoxia. Now, fluid therapy neck trauma is another big topic. And the question is always, okay, my fluid therapy is important, especially in patients that suffer from multi-trauma, because these patients are also in shock. And if they're in shock, the brain is also not well perfused, so I need to restore perfusion. However, I don't have to give too much because I can also worsen brain edema. So how can I do that? What is the best way to give these patients to restore their perfusion, however, try not to make the brain edema worse? So which fluid, how much fluid, how fast are we going to give it? So these are going to be the questions we're going to try to answer now. Now we have different fluid available. We have And the one that the majority of us would probably use in this situation would be different crystalloid solution, isotonic crystalloid solution. Doesn't matter if we're talking about sodium chloride 0.9% or a buffered isotonic crystalloid solution, which is usually the one that I prefer, like the Harman solution that you guys have, or plasma light, it depends, there are different names. Hypertonic crystalloid solution we can use, or eventually a synthetic colloid solution. Now, hypertonic solution is in this situation, in a patient that is hypovolemic and is suffering also from traumatic brain injury, as my personal first choice, not only mine. Why is that? We know that hypertonic solution is a very concentrated solution of sodium chloride, and normal physiologic is 0.9%, and a sodium and hypertonic is around 4 or 7.2%, so it's quite high. And in virtue of obviously its properties, we need very little amount of hypertonic solution to have the same effect of a large bolus of an isotonic crystalloid, because the way this fluid works is that it will increase the tonicity of the plasma, and then we would pull water from the interstitial and intracellular space back into the intravascular space, then filling up your vessel. So as you can see, normally the dose that is recommended in dogs is usually 4 to 7 mL per kilo. In cats, I forgot to put it in there, is usually much lower, it's 2 to 4 mL per kilo, in usually 15 to 20 minutes. So actually it's almost 10 times less of a bolus of an isotonic crystalloid solution. What are the properties of an hypertonic crystalloid solution and why it's usually a preferred fluid in these cases? Because again, you need a very little volume, it restores perfusion very quickly, increase very rapidly cardiac outputs, increase the cerebral blood flow, and because it would pull fluid obviously from the interstitium and from the cells, it decreases partly also cellular edema, and that also means that it will protect the brain from further development of the edema, worsening of the edema. It will decrease the intracranial pressure and will increase the oxygen delivery. So hypertonic crystalloid solution in this patient, if you have a patient that suffers from a traumatic brain injury and that is also hypovolemic, it's your fluid of choice. And you can always start with the lowest volume of the range, lowest amount of the range, that you can eventually repeat the bolus. Obviously, you're going to cause dehydration in this patient, and that's what you want. Not really what you want at the beginning, but that's what you might end up with. So this means that once again, intracranial pressure has decreased and your patient is more stable, you will have to follow up with this patient with some isotonic crystalloid solution. If you don't have or you cannot find an hypertonic solution and you only have isotonic crystalloid solution, they can also obviously be used. Treating the shock then becomes the priority, but then we have to be smart and use them in a very specific way. because we know the crystalloid solution that will redistribute in the interstitial space, if we use large volume at the time, it might actually worsen your brain edema and then worsen, in, cause an increase in intracranial pressure. So usually, besides that, we would do it anyway in a patient that suffered from trauma, but especially in a patient in which you think that it might be suffering also from traumatic brain injury, we would probably use small volumes. So usually we talk about low volume resuscitation in this patient, which means we will probably use 10 to 20 milliliter per kilo bolus in 30 minutes, 15 to 30 minutes, and then we will reevaluate the perfusion and decide if this patient requires more. And that obviously is to treat the underlying hypoperfusion. And then eventually, if still the pressure, they said you have solved the hypoperfusion and your patient still has increased intracranial pressure or mentally has not improved, then we would probably use then eventually mannitol. Colloids, we don't use them as first-line fluid. There is a lot of discussion. I'm not going to go a lot into the detail about use of colloid. Yes, no in human medicine because of a lot of side effects they tend to see, especially in proprioceptic population, so not actually really this population. But, I mean, we don't use maybe colloid really as first-line fluid. However, colloids could also be used in these cases. Why not? I don't see a particular benefit over crystalloids in traumatic brain injury patients, but if you want to use colloids, again, smaller amounts, smaller boluses as well to improve perfusion might also be, again, a good idea. So I would still use maybe 5 milliliter per kilo and then reassess what your bolus has done with your patient. Now, you probably understood that I haven't mentioned hypotonic crystalloids, and I'm 100% sure all of you already know that hypotonic crystalloids like your glucose 5% or your 0.45% sodium chloride plus 2.5% glucose should never ever be used in any patient in shock as a bolus. Now, especially in the traumatic brain injury patient, you should absolutely not use them. Why is that? Well, all this fluid, they contain a large amount of free water. Now, glucose 5% is only glucose and free water. Your 0.45% sodium chloride contains only 70 millimoles of sodium and the rest is free water. So what is free water going to do once you're going to give it to this patient? It will redistribute very quickly to the intracellular space. So it will definitely worsen cellular edema and it would definitely worsen your brain edema. So if you would use a bolus of an hypertonic crystalloid to a patient with a traumatic brain injury, you would put a risk of brain herniation, sudden death, your patient. So please don't do it. Don't use this fluid in this patient, but in any patient as treatment for hypovolemia. So when do I worry for an increase in intracranial pressure? And we said before that we cannot measure it, unfortunately. It would be crazy if we could have a small catheter that we put in the brain and we can measure the intracranial pressure, but we can't. So what if my patient that came in which I suspect is suffering from traumatic brain injury, I start my initial resuscitation, I give oxygen, I monitor, and then his mentation gets worse or doesn't improve. So which signs do I have to look for? Okay, I have to do now something to treat my intracranial pressure. Now, some of the signs we already mentioned before, right? So it would be a patient that suddenly has mentation decrease, stupor, coma, anisocoria, again, abnormality in the cranial nerves, abnormality respiratory system, or develop the cerebrated rigidity. Another very important thing, actually, to always keep an eye with, especially in multi-trauma patients, that might give you a clue that your patient might be suffering from a traumatic brain injury, is also looking at the cardiovascular system. Now, I hope now it works. We will go back to the first slides of Avatar. Now, I'm sure that most of you have already noticed that when I was talking about the physical examination in this patient, now I mentioned something that I'm sure the majority of you are like, why 50 beats per minute, her heart rate? Is it not too low? Yes, it is very low. I mean, this patient lost a lot of blood, was in shock, suffered from traumatic brain injury, so probably a massive release of catecholamine from the brain, but her heart rate was 50. Why is that? This is not a mistake of the slides, but this actually is something that you guys will have to recognize very quickly, because bradycardia associated with all the other signs, again, of decreased mentation, again, anisocoria, people unresponsive to light that we just mentioned, definitely indicates increased intracranial pressure. Why is that? So we have inappropriate bradycardia, which is very often is associated also to mild systemic hypertension. And I explain you. So this is the formula that we saw before. So our cerebral perfusion pressure is given by your mean arterial blood pressure minus your intracranial pressure. Now you have a patient that the intracranial pressure increases very much because it's a traumatic brain injury. So the cerebral blood flow will decrease. Now the body doesn't know what's happening, but it's like, hey, I don't get enough oxygen and enough blood flow to my brain. So the only things it can do to try to restore the cerebral perfusion, if you look at at this formula, is increasing your mean arterial blood pressure. So if the mean arterial pressure is going to increase very much, then it's going to counteract the increase in the intracerebral pressure. It's going to maintain the cerebral perfusion pressure and then the cerebral blood flow. However, because your body is going to be now body of the patient is going to be now hypertensive, that would cause a reflex bradycardia for which the heart rate will slow down very much. And that's what you get, and it's called the Cushing reflex or Cushing response. And the Cushing reflex is given by inappropriate bradycardia and systemic hypertension in a patient that is suffering from a traumatic brain injury. Now, the video that you're looking at is a dog that actually underwent brain surgery. I will show you another time. And the dog, while it was waking up, it was severely bradycardic and hypertensive, as you can see on the monitor. And this, for us, was definitely a sign that the patient was definitely suffering from increased intracranial pressure. Now, the hypertension, don't imagine, doesn't have per se to be 200 or 250, but also systolic pressure in a patient like this, or in a multi-trauma patient of 160, with a heart rate that is below 60, in this case, again, 42, it's enough to say that that patient has a Cushing reflex or Cushing response, and then it means that the intracranial pressure must be elevated. So again, don't overlook signs, cardiovascular signs of maybe increased intracranial pressure. So what if increased intracranial pressure? Well, then we can use two things to try to decrease your intracranial pressure. Sodium chloride hypertonics, hypertonic solution, or mannitol. Do they have the same efficacy? Can I use them interchangeably? There is a lot of discussion in human medicine about, is mannitol better? Is hypertonic solution better? What if I have a bleeding? Is mannitol going to leak in the bleeding in the brain parenchyma and then worsen edema? Is sodium chloride going to do the same? Well, I can tell you that also in human medicine, there is a lot of discussion about it. And a lot of time, the choice of using one or the other, it really depends on the clinician choice. As I said before, the fluid of choice in the initial resuscitation phase would probably be hypertonic solution because it will help you also restoring perfusion. However, if the patient deteriorates afterwards, or if, for example, the patient is not hypovolemic on presentation, so he has increased intracranial pressure because he has a brain tumor, but the dog or patient, again, cat is not hypovolemic, then mannitol would also work very well. What is mannitol? Now, we know that mannitol is an osmotic diuretic, and the way it works is hyperosmotic compared to the plasma. So initially, it would cause a minimally plasma expanding effect, decreased blood viscosity, usually lasts for minutes, and afterwards, it would then cause cerebral vasoconstriction, decrease intracranial pressure, and by virtue of its osmotic diuretic effect, it would decrease brain edema. And some people also say that mannitol might also have some antioxidant effects and free radical scavenger effects. So it is quite efficient in decreasing increasing intracranial pressure. There are a lot of dosage of mannitol given. Sometimes in book you find up to 2 grams per kilo. You can also start with smaller amounts. So I would often start with 0.25, 0.5 grams per kilo as a bolus, usually in 15, 30 minutes. You would see, you expect the effect of mannitol in the next half an hour max, and then you could eventually repeat the dose of mannitol as well. What about corticosteroids in head trauma? Well, if there is a lot of discussion about spinal trauma and corticosteroids, yes or no, I would say that when we talk about head trauma, there is absolutely no discussion. They are absolutely contraindicated. Both in human medicine and in veterinary medicine, there is quite some evidence that corticosteroids in head trauma, they will not improve patient outcome, they will not decrease brain edema, they will not do anything for the patient, but actually adding more severe side effects. What are the collateral effects of the corticosteroids? Well, we know that they would increase diuresis. Again, in a patient which you're trying maybe to stabilize because they're hypovolemic, then you have a massive diuresis caused by the corticosteroids, would cause immunosuppression, and also they will increase the glucose level. And we're going to see in a few slides that actually hyperglycemia is very bad for brain damage. So we really should avoid hyperglycemia, we really should avoid corticosteroids. So please, if you have a patient with a traumatic brain injury, do not give corticosteroids at all. It will not help, actually it will make the situation worse. What else can we do for our patient? What other therapy we can use? Well, as I said, we were talking about that before, and these are often patients with multiple trauma, patients that suffers from pain. And we know that pain will increase the sympathetic response, which again, afterwards will also increase your intracranial pressure. So is there a reason to treat pain in this patient? Yeah. Obviously, there is an ethical reason because these patients suffer from multiple trauma and pain. And secondary, if I don't treat the pain, I might not be able to stabilize my intracranial pressure. So is it scary to treat pain in this patient that are already in a coma, they already have problems with the breathing? Yes, it is. So it means that we have to be very careful in the way we use our analgesia, and we should be smart and use actually analgesic that we can, for example, reverse or antagonize. And that's why, for example, pure mu opioid, the use of a pure mu opioid like methadone, fentanyl, for example, or sulfentanyl, at lower dose that you can eventually titrate might be the best choice. Why is that? Because you can start very low, for example, and then if the patient tolerates it well and you monitor, then you can eventually increase the dose. And if you see any side effects, again, worsened respiration, hypercapnia, that you think it might be associated, then you can antagonize it with naloxone. So actually, they are quite safe analgesic and they might help you and to treat pain and also maybe to decrease the intracranial pressure in this patient if maybe the pain might contribute to that. Avoid, please, in this patient, especially if they come in hypovolemic, non-steroidal, because you might predispose them, that patient, to gastrointestinal bleeding and acute kidney injury. And there is always a lot of discussion that I put it with a question mark about ketamine. Should we avoid ketamine in this patient? Does it really cause increased intracranial pressure? It's a bit discussion about it. Obviously, when we use ketamine as in a multimodal analgesic protocol, we would use very low dose. We often talk about 3 to 4 microgram per kilo per minute. So super low dose compared to the 5 milligram per kilo when we want to use it as an anesthetic, for example, for induction. So we know that ketamine might increase intracranial pressure, but normally at the dose that we would use for analgesia doesn't seem to be associated to it. So do we really have to avoid it? Again, if it doesn't seem to be the case per se, I have to admit that I tend not to use it in the initial phase, especially if I have a high suspicion of high increase intracranial pressure. I try to, as I say, use something that eventually I can reverse initially. If my patient is afterwards, I've treated him or becomes a little bit more stable, but it's still very painful, then I rather maybe add ketamine instead of keep on increasing my opioids, also to avoid any side effects like respiratory depression associated to high dose of opioid. But maybe, as I said, I would personally avoid it maybe in the initial phase. What did we do with Avatar? Now, Avatar, when she came in, she received a bolus of an hypertonic saline. We started with 2 milliliters per kilo, and we repeated the bolus twice. I started by giving initially 0.1 milligram per kilo methadone, and as soon as she became a bit more comfortable, we increased it to 0.2, which was actually a little bit quite painful. Now, afterwards, avatar improved. However, a few hours afterwards, her mentation decreased again. So that's where I gave her a dose of mannitol. I gave her 0.5 grams per kilo. And afterwards, she did improve. She became, as you can see also in this video, still obviously neurological, but more responsive. She was not constantly turning on herself. So I then decided to start just with maintenance fluid therapy. I didn't want to give any correction. Other treatment, other things we should consider in this patient. Now, obviously, we were talking before about hyperglycemia. And hyperglycemia has been associated with severity of the lesion, increased lactate, and worsening of acidosis of the central nervous system, especially in human medicine. We don't know if there is a similar correlation in veterinary patients as well. But again, we should probably avoid, again, as I said, only fluid containing glucose and especially the corticosteroids. So be aware of the hypoglycemic effect of some drugs you're using. Another big point of discussion is, do we have to start in this patient that suffers from traumatic brain injury? Do we have to start an anti-epileptic drug? Well, I don't think there is yet in veterinary medicine a big consensus. In human medicine, the prophylactic treatment, it is actually recommended in traumatic brain injury patients. They saw that actually 3.5% in hospital and almost 7% post-discharge in dogs, let's say, post a trauma of seizure. So the question is, should we try also in our patients to start, or should we consider starting, for example, phenobarbital also in our traumatic brain injury patients, once they're obviously doing already a little bit better in a prophylactic way, even if they didn't suffer from seizure? Yes, probably it's something that we should consider. However, as you can see, the incidence is not very high, so it means that the majority of the patient would probably receive phenobarbital and never develop seizure. However, obviously, some of this patient might. And I'm not 100% sure if there is an association probably between severity of the damage and chance of developing seizure. So as I said, I'm not aware of a big recommendation in veterinary medicine what to do. I think it will depend a lot on the neurological signs of the patients and a little bit how you feel eventually to start or not phenobarbital. Other treatment to consider in this patient, and you saw the video that I show you initially of this patient with a severe increase in intracranial pressure. You saw that the head was elevated from the body almost in an angle of 45 degrees. And the idea is that we should avoid every compression of the jugular in this patient, because obviously by compressing the jugular, or if you have a dog that is lying with his neck flexed, that might again cause a jugular compression, then the venous blood flow from the brain will decrease and will again increase the intracranial pressure. So keep the head elevated 30-45 degrees, avoid to compress the jugular, avoid to take blood from the jugular, and hopefully that would also increase a bit the venous drainage and avoid increasing intracranial pressure. Other treatment, these were mainly talking about patients that are surviving the initial 24-48 hours, considering this patient might take a long time actually for them to improve fully. So nutrition, when possible, enterally should be considered. Obviously, these are also patients that maybe are recumbent, they're not very good in swallowing, so always weigh the benefit of an enteral nutrition for the GI tract versus possibility of regurgitation and aspiration pneumonia. And if you're not trusting the patient or the patient is still too sedated or too, again, stuporous or comatose, always in lateral recumbency, then maybe for this patient for a few initial days, again, consider partial parenteral nutrition. Obviously, these are, we said before, a recumbent patient, and they might not be able to walk, they might not be able to stand for a few days. So keeping the bladder empty, it's also fundamental. A bladder that is distended is also cause pain, which you're trying also to avoid. So always try to have a urinary catheter in place so that you can have an empty bladder without having to express it multiple times per day. And if your animal is recumbent for a very long time, then consider also to doing some passive physiotherapy, really to avoid muscle atrophy and the fact that after a few days of recumbency, that patient might have actually problem walking. Our patient need monitoring, yes, absolutely, like every multiple trauma patient. Is there any way that I can monitor the progression of a traumatic brain injury? Yes, there is a scale which is called the Glasgow or the modified Glasgow Coma Scale. And the Glasgow Coma Scale evaluates three important things: motor activity, brainstem reflex, and level of consciousness. And as you can see, there are different sort of description of how the motor activity, the brainstem reflex, and the level of consciousness are in your patient, and there is a score given. And at the end, you can do the sum of the scoring, and you have an actual modified Glasgow Coma Scale score. And that is being associated ideally to prognosis. You see that this, at a certain point, if you look at the smaller side, it is suggestive prognosis, grave, guarded, or good. Now, I don't like to use the modified Glasgow Coma Scale on admission to say or to give an honorary prognosis, because I think often these animals are hypovolemic, or you might not be able to assess initially the real situation of your patient. But so giving, you know, immediately a prognosis based on a scoring on an animal that just came in as an emergency, I find it maybe not very representative for the real situation which the animal might be. However, the modified Glasgow Coma Scale might be used for you and for your colleagues and for the nurse to monitor how the patient progressed during the hospitalization. Obviously, what you want is what you want to see an improvement on your patient. So if, for example, from guarded, your patient scoring start improving, yeah, then probably is associated with a better prognosis than if from, for example, guarded, your scoring gets smaller and smaller, and then is associated more to a grave prognosis. So maybe, as I said before, all this monitoring system, don't just use them to say, I'm sorry, we're not going to treat your patient because the modified Glasgow Coma Scale gave me a very bad prognosis, but use it during your treatment to evaluate the response of your patient to treatment. Now, another point I wanted to make before I conclude is that when we talk about treating these patients, treating a traumatic brain injury patients, it's not something that we should expect to solve in a day or two. So this means also that we have have an idea or give to the owner a good idea of what they should expect. So if an owner say, oh, please try for 24 hours and I want to see if my dog or cat will get better, if they suffer from a severe traumatic brain injury, 24 hours might not be enough. Often they require days and sometimes even weeks for them to fully recuperate. Now, it doesn't mean that a patient needs to be in your intensive care for weeks, but again, often they might require 2 to 3 days for you to have a better idea in which direction this patient is actually going. So manage expectation of the owner is also very important in these patients, besides obviously I'm always talking very openly about the cost of hospitalization for this patient. But give your patient time, because they might require time to improve. What is the outcome? Well, as you can see, that prognosis, the mortality is still elevated. But now, 18-25%, it's not too bad, which means that if we treat appropriately and we approach appropriately this patient, they might actually really improve. Now, what are the obviously negative prognostic indicators? Yes, poor perfusion, severe concurrent injury, meaning hemoabdomen, pulmonary contusion, pneumothorax, fractures, and obviously, fair enough, the lowers modified Glasgow Coma score. But as I said before, is it really per se associated to prognosis or survival in the first 48 hours? Maybe yes or maybe no, but as I said before, this for me is very important. Dogs and cats have really the ability to make a remarkable neurological recovery, so I would not put a stamp on them in the first 24 hours of, okay, this prognosis is really bad just because you have a score from the Glasgow, but I will give you again your patient time. However, as I said before, you need to see an improvement in this patient and not that they get worse. So take home message from this presentation: traumatic brain injury is a common consequence of blunt trauma in our patients. So always in a patient that comes in after a trauma, evaluate also from a neurological point of view. Try to pick up those signs that might be associated with traumatic brain injury. Rapid ABCD, so major body system assessment, should be able to identify those patients. So rapid cardiovascular and respiratory stabilization, rapid assessment of if there is an increase in intracranial pressure and we have to intervene either with hypertonic saline with mannitol, we need to monitor our patient very well. And again, we have to give them enough time eventually to get better. This is the last video. Obviously, I chose a case that ended up well, but this was Avatar a few weeks later, still not doing completely okay and still quite neurological, but she was able obviously to stand, she was able to walk, wagging her tail, and she was an happy dog. And Avatar then improved completely after a few more weeks again with the owners. So this was the end of the presentation. I see there are a couple of questions, so I will try to answer. Now, the first question is, if can mannitol be used as first line fluid in patients with polytrauma and traumatic brain injury? It's a very good question. Now you notice probably in the presentation that I haven't talked about mannitol in the initial stabilization of the patient. And why is actually that? I haven't talked about mannitol because we say before the mannitol is an osmotic diuretic. So actually, if you have a patient that comes in after a multi-trauma and they are hypovolemic, hypotensive, with increased intracranial pressure, and you give them mannitol as first-line fluid, well, that patient will probably become even more hypoperfused because the idea of the mannitol is to get rid of the fluid. So by worsening the perfusion in that patient, you probably will also worsen the perfusion to the brain. So mannitol should not be used as first fluid in an hypovolemic patient. Then I'd rather use small volume resuscitation with a nasotonic crystalloid, stabilize the hypoperfusion, and eventually use mannitol afterwards. Or again, definitely hypertonic solution, that would be my fluid of choice. And the other question that I see is a question on therapeutic hypothermia in our patient, if we should do that. It's another very good question. It's a very complicated question, so I will try to answer very quickly. Now, what it means with therapeutic hypothermia is that in human medicine, or targeted hypothermia is often talked about in human medicine, especially in patients that suffer from either cardiopulmonary arrest or traumatic brain injury, they try to target a temperature around 32, 34 degrees centigrade to maintain, or let's say, to give more chances of survival to these patients. Hypothermia, it has been associated, it's true, with decreased cerebral metabolism, decreased, again, release of pro-inflammatory cytokines, decreased worsening of brain damage. However, we don't have to forget that in human medicine, first of all, they don't use that first treatment. So also for them, targeted hypothermia is a secondary, let's say, treatment in patients that do not respond to normal treatment and their refractory seizure. And the problem is that severe hypothermia has also been associated with severe cardiovascular, respiratory, and let's say general metabolic abnormalities. So human patients that in which therapeutic hypothermia is used are patients that are normally ventilated, they are super well monitored, and the temperature is and everything is monitored so that this low temperature is not causing more damage actually than goods. And I think there is in veterinary medicine only one case report, if I'm correct, of a dog that was treated successfully with hypothermia. However, there are also many more reports of dogs that didn't do so well, where, again, targeted hypothermia was used. So I have to admit, I personally don't use it. We personally don't use it in this hospital. I would try maybe not to rewarm the patient if its temperature is around 36.5, 36 degree, I would keep again this temperature, but I would personally not target much lower again body temperature, because often in veterinary medicine we don't have the possibility to monitor them so well, and then I'm afraid that the targeted hypothermia then might become again causing more damage to the patients. So that was it for this presentation. I want to thank everyone again that listened and followed this presentation, and I wish you a very good afternoon.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Chiara for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.